Welcome to Season 9 of Retrain Your Brain for Success with me, psychologist Dr. Audrey Tang. This season is a special guest season where I get inspired by the ideas and innovations from well-being experts and advocates, as well as reflect with them on their experiences and how they have been able to dig deep within themselves in order to flourish. Tonight, my special guest is Director of Planning and Landscape and Senior Vice President of Global Architectural Firm WATG, John Goldwyn. Welcome to Retrain Your Brain, John.
Thank you, Audrey. It's lovely to be here.
It's a pleasure having you here. Now, John is the Senior Vice President and Director of Master Planning and Landscape at WATG London. WATG are the architectural minds behind Dubai's Atlantis, the Venetian in Las Vegas, and London's Claridge's. And their focus is not just on designing the outer beauty admired by the world, but ensuring that it's a reflection of the inner strength and stories of the land and the communities engaging within it. Now, John, I always talk about the importance of acknowledging and accepting what's already there when I'm talking about personal change. And this is actually something I noticed that's fundamental to your design when you're master planning. So why is appreciation of the history of the story of the land so important to you?
I think, Audrey, it works on so many different levels. At the most basic, there's a reason that things are in the places that they're in. There's a reason that London sits on a navigable river from many thousands of years ago. There's a reason that fortified cities were built on high land so that they could survey the approaching enemy. So some of it is super pragmatic, and it's about human survival and people giving themselves the best odds they possibly could have to survive in a certain place. And some of it's just really interesting historical facts that kind of interweave with that. And I guess that's what place is. It's this mesh between the sort of pragmatic historical layers of settlement with all of these incredible things that happened in these places along the way. And you look up the history of a place and there's always been a fire and, you know, there's always been all of these interesting, there's been a murder or two and somehow, it's not all negative. I'm painting a very negative picture, but it somehow places is the association and the memory that goes with the place, along with this sort of pragmatic layer as well. I mean, to give a really simple example, you know, the three little pigs, or building a castle of sand on the beach. And so all of these things, that's basically my job, is understanding why things are in the places that they're in. And then, if you like, understanding that place to actually make sure that they can prosper and thrive moving forwards.
Because you don't tear it down. And that's also relating to my job as well. It's about understanding what's there and why it's there and how that's helped the person survive and then flourish. But then because they want to make the changes or they want to tweak certain things, it's about working with what's there in order to help them. And I notice those similarities. So how do you answer the people who say that architects just tear things down?
That is an approach. If you look at the master plan for somewhere like Brasilia, a new city where everything is linear and laid out in a sort of slightly alarming mathematical grid, there is a school of thought that believes that, you know, the architect is at the top of the pyramid of genius and is creating the places in which people live. I think that that's incredibly naive. That's the same as a friend or a client that decides they're going to be something one week and then something else the next week. It's very, very difficult to reinvent land. I mean, there are examples. If you look at Las Vegas, a city in the desert, or Dubai, a city in the desert, you can work against nature, but it's really hard work. I mean, do you know how often the channels around Dubai are dredged so that the ships can still get through and they stay navigable? You're working against nature, and long term, you're going to lose, aren't you? It's not going to prosper.
Whilst I guess there is success certainly in Dubai and in Vegas, there must be some kind of payoff.
It's an economic payoff. I mean, again, what I always do when I go to a site, I design a lot of hotels. So if I go to a site, the first thing I do is I visit the property very early in the morning and I close my eyes and I feel the rising sun and how that feels on my face. And then I'll go back in the evening and feel how the setting sun feels, because all the good bits are already there. I mean, that you don't need to know about landscape history to pick up this kind of basic site stuff. So a lot of it's already there. And yeah, if you build a house in the desert, in the hot desert. I mean, you can follow what the Bedouin did and build a tent. That's the sustainable way to live, not to build a big glass pyramid. The indigenous Americans and their igloos are the most sustainable buildings. And, you know, you need just a candle to keep an igloo warm in a really cold temperature, because it's minded towards the place that it's built. As soon as you try to build a tent in the snow, then you've got trouble. So much of it is just about understanding how a building use or a land use is related to the land that you propose it.
That's just such a great philosophy for life. Sometimes we need to just stop and recognize who we are when the sun comes up and when the sun goes down, and then work with that and embrace it.
Again, if you take designing a place, there's good stuff, and you make the best of the beautiful sunset view, and you hide the view of the factory next door. So it's the same with ourselves. There's fabulous stuff that we can celebrate and hone and polish, and other stuff that you probably have to work on a little bit more. I think that's the case for all of us.
That's exactly why you wrote the foreword to my book. So, now, I've heard a lot about this concept of smart cities. Now, I know about smartphones, but what does a smart city entail, and how does that help our well-being as a community?
Yeah, sadly, I don't have 3 hours to explain this in great depth, but I guess the highlights, the bullet points on this are: smart cities are based around using particular technologies to enhance the experience of the people that live within the city, but also the people that operate the city, to help them understand through data points. So firstly, there's something slightly sinister about smart cities. Let me give you an example. You get home to your apartment and the air conditioning switches on when you're at the end of your street because it knows that you're coming home. Great on that level. The not so good level is, you know, you've been having an illicit affair with someone and your apartment knows about it and decides to tell your partner, and actually you weren't having an illicit affair, you were actually meeting your sister and your face was identified wrong. So that the ability for it to be sinister is there. And there's the Google Pavement Project, for example, which is Google's smart city technology. And it's all based around tracking vehicles. And some of it is incredible. And some of it has not gone down too well because of the two examples I give. So when we work with smart cities, what we're trying to do really is look at the positive side of what you can do with smart cities and be honest about the fact as well. So smart cities, they're a buzzword at the moment, but I guess the crux of the philosophy of a smart city is that it uses technology and it uses different data points to give a better living experience.
That's a lesson for us when it comes to technology. There are so many amazing uses of technology, like medical technology, but it can really run away with us if we don't know how to control it.
We were asked to design a smart city in, for example, in Mauritius. We're working on something in Mauritius at the moment. And the notion of the smart city really is far broader. It's called a smart city as a kind of catchphrase for the government and for PR. But really, we're working with trying to bring indigenous nature that's been lost through farming back into Mauritius. We're looking at re-establishing ecosystems within, like, nature within the city. So for me, the smartest creator, if you like, of all is Mother Nature, and to use that in the context of a city to me feels very comfortable. We've managed to take a very high-tech concept and then furnish it with a lot of low-tech but very sensible natural systems.
Now, John, there have recently been more and more articles discussing how we've all been heading back to nature because of the pandemic, but for me, I honestly believe the call was always there, but we haven't always been listening. So in terms of the global trends that you see, is this biophilia, which is our love of nature, a new thing brought on by having to go to the park during COVID, or is it something that's always been there and is just now finally getting a bit more traction?
I think that this series of horrific events over the last months and years has just put such a sharp focus on what's important to us as beings and what's important to our society. Do you imagine with the advent of the car, then lots of North American cities and then places around the world were designed around cars. They weren't designed around people. You look at the places that we always love to visit, Istanbul or Barcelona or parts of London, have a medieval city that was designed for people. Marketplaces and narrow streets and everything that we love. And I think that when you start imagining that actually our cities and our local area, that the sort of importance of them has been reimagined, suddenly it all starts fitting together. The landscape isn't the spaces in between the places that we visit. It's the very glue that sticks the fabric of the city together.
Whilst you're talking, I was reflecting on what I like about Northampton, because when I first moved here, a lot of people who have lived here all their lives, and perhaps we always have this feeling about where we've lived all our lives, they all said, oh, you know, you've moved here, we've all been trying to get out. But one of the things that I love about it is the Market Square. And I know we've got some funds to regenerate it now, which is really exciting. But the market is just something that we would have to cross to get to the shopping centre. But it's the place that I just love spending the most time. And until you were talking, I never really formally recognised that.
I used to rush to the supermarket to do my shopping. And then when COVID hit, guess what? The supermarket shelves were empty for a while. And it's like, well, what are we going to do? How about wandering 25 metres away from where I live down to the little street and buy a loaf of bread from one place and some eggs from somewhere else. And it starts to all fit together. And we kind of had done everything we possibly could to make our cities as inhuman as possible through, as I said, it's through this kind of dominance of the car. As soon as you actually say, let's understand what's happening locally, then that's when it starts to get really interesting. So instead of crossing your market square to the shopping, you shop in the market square. And that's what it's there for. And I think there's a real resurgence, and this was long before COVID, there was a resurgence of farmers markets and pop-up street bazaars and all of these kind of things. And they bring in people who live in the area and tourists, and people congregate. And we're very social beings, aren't we? And this is really the way that I think that biophilia plays into that as well, because as soon as you start pulling nature into the city as well, then you have this incredible synthesis, this apex between humanity and the social side of us, and then the nature that relaxes and invigorates and energizes us as well.
Singapore was offering a green mark for healthier workplaces, and they've been doing that since 2018. And they're recognizing that sustainable design and energy and response management and even the office environment do contribute to mental health and well-being. So with that in mind, what are some of the favorite of your innovations that you've seen or even designed when it comes to enhancing our feelings of positivity?
I grew up near Richmond Park in London, and I navigate Richmond Park through where I remember the beautiful oak trees are. I now live near Dulwich Park, and my favorite moment of that is a huge sculptural walnut tree that has these enormous spreading branches that are leaning down like an old man leaning on a bar to steady himself as he has a drink. The innovation of nature itself is the thing that really inspires me. And I think as soon as we try and design something that somehow is more amazing than that, it's probably not going to impress me that much. But I guess a lot of what inspires me about urbanism is applicable to buildings. When we moved into our new office in Covent Garden a few years ago, we created almost like a street down the middle of the office with little touchdown meeting spaces rather than having too much formal meeting space. And what I really love is the fact that you can just, as you're walking down, it's like walking down the street, down the middle of the office, and you have a little moment of chatting to someone. Maybe you've got your notebook with you and you take a couple of notes, or maybe you're on your way to the cafe down at the end of the office to have a cup of tea, and you stop and you drink your tea with them. And it's all about this sort of social interaction. So you move away from the idea of offices being about compartmentalized space around a person and start to actually play on this notion of social interaction like a street. And I think it's not kind of, if you like, deep innovation, but it's understanding that we as social beings, our spaces are really important to the way that we work and the quality of our work and how happy we are at work.
I love that because, again, you're back to the market square concept, because that meeting point is somewhere that you're going on your way to somewhere, but it becomes a feature in itself. You've written in a previous article that landscape architecture is clearly not just about how spaces look. It's about how we think and feel when we inhabit that space. And certainly environmental psychologists would agree that behavior can be predicted by the setting. So what are some of the problems that you recognize within some of our current spaces as relating to mental ill health, and how might we implement some changes?
It takes me right back to university when we used to study, you know, we'd be given, they'd say, design a piazza, design a public square in, you know, wherever it is. And the first thing everyone would do is say, okay, we need an amphitheater. We're going to put an amphitheater in the middle. And I'm, you know me, I'm terrified of performing in a play or something like that. I mean, I have done it, but it's absolutely terrifying to me. The thought of having an amphitheater in my local piazza, that's really scary. And as soon as you try and force a use onto a place, I think you have a problem. However, if you put in an informal place for seating where people can congregate and go and chat or read a book, I'm absolutely fine with that. And I'll be the first person to sit there and read my book. I think it's really important to just let people do what they need to do. Many places have this error that they were designed for something that the architect thought was the right use, without really understanding that people just need to do what they need to do at the end of the day.
The funny thing is, before I even knew you, I have seen and I have even stayed in some of those luxury hotels that your firm has designed or worked on. And I loved them. But that was a luxury. So what can we do to maybe improve our own little corner of the world at home if we don't have any of this technology or any money even?
Other than my family, my favorite friends in my house are my houseplants. And what houseplants can do is they can make you feel like your own little tropical resort or desert resort or whatever you fancy, but within your house. And the other added benefit is they take pollutants and dust out of the air. And so they're essentially purifying your air, and they're breathing carbon dioxide in and oxygen out. And I think that you can do something creative, but also really positive with houseplants.
I have learned so much from you today. Thank you so much for joining me, John.
It's been an absolute pleasure being here. I've thoroughly enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
And that's all we have time for. But for more positive psychology exercises, check out my YouTube channel, Dr. Audrey Tang Tools to Thrive. Visit my website, www.draudreyt.com, where you can also purchase copies of my books. Or alternatively, join me on NLive Radio, Tuesdays 9 p.m. in the Wellbeing Lounge.